Today, I am speaking with Yasser Arguelles Snape. Yasser is also known by the screen name Negate Online and works on a number of compiler-related projects. That includes his project TB, which is an optimizing backend library similar to LLVM, and Quick, spelled C-U-I-C-K, a compiler frontend for C. Yasser has a lot of ambitious ideas about what could be done to improve our computing ecosystem, and I wanted to have him on to talk about some of these ideas. We discuss what he's doing with TB and how it compares to LLVM, the comparison of ahead-of-time and just-in-time compilation systems, and ways to build a debuggable runtime system using lessons from that just-in-time system. Unfortunately, I made a mistake during the recording of this conversation, and the quality of the audio on my track is a bit worse than usual because of that. It may be a bit off-putting at first, but it's still good enough to understand the discussion, and I think it's a very interesting discussion and well worth it. With that, here is my conversation with Yasser.
All right, I'm here talking to Yasser today. Yasser, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. My name is Yasser. I work on Quick and TB. That's my compiler, my C compiler and backend.
Yeah, so I'm going to take us through a couple of different topics here today. I think Quick and TB are pretty interesting. And I know you like to talk about JIT stuff a lot too. And I don't know how that factors into Quick and TB, but I'd love to learn about that and your sort of vision of how a low-level JIT environment could be a much better way for low-level programming to be done. So I'd like to slowly get to all of that. But before we jump into all of it, could we start with just sort of your background experience and sort of like how you got into programming, how you got into low-level stuff like C, and then compilers and optimizers up to the TB project?
Sure. It was maybe 10 years ago when I started on Java tutorials around doing game stuff. So it was like little platformers, basic stuff like that. And then I slowly moved towards doing 3D stuff, still in Java. At some point, I picked up Thin Matrix, who is a YouTuber who I believe is still around, actually. Hmm. I had watched his tutorials. I had gone from there, transitioned over to other YouTubers, which one of them being Ryan Flurry. He got me into knowing about Casey, and then from Casey, around this time I was transitioning to C++, by the way, and then so I had gone from Java to C++, and then Ryan Flurry had gotten me to Casey, which had gotten me to think about C++ differently. So instead of writing as many sort of modern C++ oddities, I would try to cut that stuff down, and eventually I had tried to explain some details of C++ to somebody, and didn't feel like teaching them C++. I only needed the C parts and use C. Then I just stuck with it for a long time, and that was basically around 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Most of that journey was done doing game programming, but some of that was compilers and languages. I was working on my own language. I decided I cared more about doing backend stuff than languages, so I decided to make my own backend that was going to be focused on being a library, being flexible like LLVM, except ideally this time good. And then from there, I took it to, I want to just do the backend. That backend became TB, and as a test case, I decided to make a C compiler as a proof that a faster C compiler could be made. And so far, it's gone pretty good. Mm-hmm. And that's today.
Yeah. Cool. So I'll go back over one piece there. You said you wanted to make something kind of like LLVM. It's like a library backend, so it could be reused by different languages, and it takes over that optimization part of the problem. But you wanted it to be LLVM, but good. So I'm curious, for anyone who's not listening, because it's sort of LLVM in some ways is thought of as the state of the art of compiler optimization. So what is the parts? What are the parts that you mean are not good? Is it the optimization quality? Is it other stuff? What's your read on what you can do better than LLVM?
So the big thing is that if I were to take LLVM today and I were to, I guess, put it through a sort of thought experiment, if I were to refactor it, could I make a version of LLVM that did the same optimizations, but did them in a faster manner, did them on a simpler architecture? Is that like possible? And the answer is mostly yes. Hmm. A lot of the research that's been done has already been done. It's not like you need to go search through ancient scrolls. These are public things. It's an open source code base. You can learn from it. And there are actually very important things to learn from it. And The idea is that there are also many things that they got wrong, because LLVM, which is the backend for Clang and the, you know, the overarching toolchain for all of that C++ stuff. So if you're on a console, if you are on Apple, those are the main toolchains mostly. Mm-hmm. If you're on a GPU, there's a good chance your shader compiler is that. If you're on a Windows machine, you might be using Clang on some of your applications. There's a variety of different places where LLVM gets used. And the sort of the issue is that 20 years ago, certain decisions were made. And because it is a code base that is managed by a bunch of people, it is hard to change those decisions later. So it takes years to make even small changes. And big changes are just impossible. Mm-hmm. LLVM is probably never going to be capable of good multithreading. LLVM is probably never going to change the way that they handle instructions, which would make it run faster, even without dropping optimizations. Just changing the data layout of the sort of core instructions and how they represent their programs would improve things quite a lot. Mm. And so I'm hoping to sort of fix those sorts of problems. I'm hoping to change the way that I represent the type system, the way that I represent instructions, the way that I talk about lowering or optimizations, and also be able to do this stuff in a more parallel or slash concurrent manner, and ideally be competitive with them in a few years. It's going to take a while, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds ambitious, but it sort of also sounds like you're saying you could take LLVM and split it into two parts. There's the theory behind it of how to write an optimizer that you're mostly saying you can learn from that part. That part is good, and it's 20 years of research, and they've really figured out how an optimizer ought to work, but then their code has 20 years of cruft, and you are saying we could really pull that all that valuable research out and just put a nice simple design on top of it rather than trying to continuously like be backwards compatible with old versions of LLVM or work within this giant code base. Is that kind of your take? Like the techniques they're using are okay, but the like coding style and structures around it are just not holding it back?
Yeah, I would say that's mostly true. There are a few places where I disagree with them in the theoretical aspect, and I hope to tackle that stuff.
Interesting. I know we're going to kind of avoid getting too deep into that, but could you give us some ideas of what kinds of techniques modern optimizers are using? And instead of, we don't need to get into the details of how they work, but what are just some things that a curious person who hasn't researched this before could go and pull on? Like what threads should you go after if you want to learn about what's happening in state-of-the-art optimizers?
I guess I would pick something. I'd pick something sort of intermediate because it has the most pull. So, an example might be to do with loop optimization. So, everyone's heard of loop unrolling. If you haven't, it's basically just take a loop. It's going to do a bunch of iterations. It might be beneficial if we can dispatch multiple iterations one after the other without looping around. And so, we'll just basically copy and paste the loop body a few times. Mm-hmm. And so, it'll be like, oh, I started with one iteration per back edge. So back edge is when you jump back to the top.
Okay.
And so I started with one, now I've got four, and those four might be vectorizable. So you can take that and you can use SIMD on it. And now you can improve the performance of that code. And so when you're dealing with arrays and you're dealing with lots of data, this can be really beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
You might see people even do this manually sometimes. It's generally speaking better to do it manually just because compilers have a lot of trouble with vectorization. A lot of that has to do with the semantics of the languages, and that's one of those problems that I do not think I would be able to fix within C, but we'll see how other languages that end up using TB will deal with those problems.
Interesting, interesting. So yeah, vectorization is an interesting topic. What is advice that you have in terms of how good these optimizers are? Should people turn on auto vectorizers and hope that it's working better? Do you think it's better to stick with simpler optimizations that LLVM can do?
I would say that there's a lot of it that is like a back and forth of building up intuition with your compiler. So it's staring at it at Godbolt. It's taking the debugger and saying show disassembly. And doing that a bunch of times gets you a big intuition on where the optimizer sort of fails at. Because the idea is that the optimizer is trying to perform certain optimizations, and it's got an understanding of your program, and it's got certain understanding of the sort of assumptions it's allowed to make, and the like the rules you've sort of embedded into your code. So like if you say that you wanted to write to a certain location, it's going to expect to do that. But if you said later that you wanted to write to that location, override the original value, if nobody was loading from the original value, it could delete the intermediate load. And so that is a detail you've embedded into it, and understanding what these sorts of details are is basically the key to understanding when you can rely on it and when you can't. And so to give an example, if you have a loop and you are doing some operation that does, let's say we have a loop and it's writing over some array, it's just crunching numbers or something. One of the big problems that LLVM will run into, and just compilers in general, is aliasing. Basically, you have two pointers in this like loop iteration and they're both changing. And so if these two pointers were overlapping, then they would mutate each other. But if they weren't, then they wouldn't touch each other. And thus, we'd avoid a bunch of weird problems where you have to reload the numbers. And so if the if you can tell the compiler that you are not aliasing two things, that's a really helpful feature. There are some aggressive ways which they try to resolve this information, but they really don't work for C. So this is where strict aliasing as a term comes from, which is they try to find out what the aliasing information is based off of the type. So they say, oh, it's an integer, that's a float. They can't alias, but it's C. You can cast anything to whatever.
Right. So aliasing is a pretty interesting topic, and definitely, I think, a good example of where optimizations start to get hairy. So maybe it'd be useful to go back and review this a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I'll give my understanding of aliasing and aliasing in C in particular. Sure. And then you can take it from there and explain, you know, how this turns into more theory for like what you're doing versus what LLVM has done, and if you're keeping what they did or changing it. But let me give you my dump first, since I can kind of get us halfway there, and you can tell us more about the topic after that. So from my understanding, aliasing, as you already described in there, arises when you have two different pointers in a block or a scope or something. Like you have a function, let's say, or a loop. And there are two different variables that are both pointer types. I'm taking the C perspective here, but obviously sure. This sort of thing could appear in another language, but I'm going to take C with pointers, and I have two pointers. And often we assume that two names are names for different things. You know, X and Y are two different things. They're different names. But if they're pointers, they can both technically contain the same address, or even, you know, they could be contain overlapping ranges of memory. So I can have a pointer to a struct called X and a pointer to a struct called Y that happen to overlap each other in some way. And then what happens is you might think when you're writing your compiler, well, if I've, you know, got five writes to the X pointer, I can enough and no reads in between on the X pointer, I could just ignore the first four writes and take the fifth one, right? But if you have reads on the Y pointer, you might actually have the read on the Y pointer depend on the write from the X pointer in a way that's sort of hidden from the names, right? The names of the variables don't reflect the fact that actually these are connected, and the optimizer can't know that for sure in every case. So when the optimizer doesn't figure out whether or not these alias, it's forced to manually actually do the writes and actually do the reads. Whereas if it knew for sure these things didn't overlap in any case, it could generate different code. And then languages like C, what they did is say things like, okay, if two things, you know, the rules are kind of complicated, so I won't get all the way into them. But if sure. two things are pointers to different types, then they don't alias is basically the rule. There's some tricks in there to make sure that, like, you can have a pointer to a member that's inside of a struct and not get confused. And unsigned characters, I think, are exempt so that you can have buffers that are always possible to alias. But, like, there's these rules, fairly complicated, about when the compiler is allowed to assume aliasing is happening or not. And from my understanding, LLVM sort of has a lot of the assumptions from the C world of aliasing sort of baked in, and makes it hard to do a different story of how you get around aliasing. So where are we at? Is that a correct story? Did I miss important subtleties along the way? What do you think?
No, I think that's good. Let me think. There's a bunch of oddities that come from that whole, oh, we have a bunch of dependencies, because there's a lot of times when users actually do know what things alias, and it's really hard to communicate that to the compiler. Usually there are languages that actually have tools for this kind of stuff, but they are a bit too heavy-handed. So an example is Rust. Rust's ownership model actually means that if If you know who owns the pointer, that's who can. That's the only person who's actually allowed to sort of write to the pointer. Not necessarily own. I don't want to go into the depths of the Rust type system, but essentially, Rust's ownership system means that it knows who's aliasing what at all times, which is a really helpful feature, but it also comes at the cost of needing to write your code in such a way where the Rust compiler understands it. And if you are not a fan of Rust, I wouldn't recommend trying to force that onto yourself. It's not worth it to get that aliasing win if you're coming to Rust just for that aliasing win. You shouldn't come to Rust, basically.
So is this a problem that you think the theory of how to solve it is pretty much settled, or is this one of the cases where you want to improve upon the story of aliasing in TB?
So there's a few ways in which I want to improve on it. LLVM's model has sort of changed over the years, because since Rust was like one of the first languages to use LLVM to actually care about aliasing, they ran into a bunch of problems in the last few years actually to do with that. And so they've refactored their system, I think, twice now. And Rust has had to turn it on and off a few times to get things sorted before they turn it back on. And so the idea is basically you have these concepts of memory objects. They're just allocations. They can have pointers into them. And the idea is that any pointer refers to one memory object and then maybe some offset into it. So it's like a little view into these little memory objects. Two memory objects do not alias, and within a memory object, you can say more strict things about their aliasing. So like, two fields in a struct don't alias because they just simply have offsets that don't overlap. And like, that's an easy case. The harder case is when it's two arbitrary pointers. But if you can say both pointers are from different objects, then now you can actually talk about aliasing in a more sane way. And in my opinion, this is the superior model, and this is the one I'm going for. LLVM has tried to go for something around doing this, except tying it to scopes. I don't think that I need to tie it to scopes myself to actually get languages with scopes to work with it.
Interesting. It seems like a lot of what LLVM contains is useful, but you're also exploring beyond it theoretically, which is interesting. And I'm trying to think of some way to explain a little bit more examples like that. I don't know if you have anything comes to mind, but are there interesting things that optimizers deal with other than aliasing where you're toying with the theory side of things?
So optimizers are, so as a backend, the idea is that you're taking some source program. The user is in like the compiler developer is taking some representation of the program that they've got, converting it into your idea of what program should look like, and then you run passes over that. And so there is a bunch of different passes, a bunch of different rules that just rewrite simple things. So it'll be things like, oh, if I see 2 + 2, I can say that's just 4. I don't have to do that computation. And it gets more complicated. It might be things like factoring out what's it called? Common terms. So it'll be, so this is called common sub-expression elimination, which is a really fancy long word, but essentially, if you see the same expression happen twice, you can just share it and do it once. And if the expression is expensive, then this is something that wins us something. There's a bunch of these other little tiny optimizations, and they're actually really important. They sort of get neglected in a lot of ways, which is that people think about the stars in the optimizer world, the inlining, the unrolling, but a lot of those things wouldn't be possible without very dumb, simple optimizations around things like being able to reassociate numbers. So like if I've got X plus Y plus Z, I've written that with binary operations. So they've got one grouping. So it might be like X and then Y plus Z is like grouped together. I might want to flip that ordering, and it's associative. So I can do that. Or at least I can with integers, not floats, because floats are nasty.
Yeah, that's interesting. So let's back up and cover that just a little bit more slowly. So for some operations, you're saying like integer addition, the only thing that matters when I'm adding integers together, in fact, they're commutative and associative, right? So exactly. The only thing that matters is which integers are in the set, essentially, at the end. It doesn't matter what order I put them together in, and it doesn't matter if I group them in different ways. So I could say, first add the X and the Y and then throw the Z in. I could say, first add the Y and the Z and then throw the X in. And I can switch their order around freely too. I could start with the Z on the left, or I could put the X on the left of the order, and you get the same sum. And obviously not every operation is that way. But so that's what these properties like associative and commutative mean mathematically. And you're saying that knowing stuff like that, before we get to the complex sort of, what did you say, the stars optimization, like inlining and loop unrolling, there are these simpler things like, and I don't think you quite got there, but I wanted to just make sure I understood what you were saying. So there's these parts of the code that have properties like being associative and or commutative, and those let you do these smaller kind of optimizations you were getting to?
Yeah. These are what we would call people optimizations. The idea is that people is because it is looking through a sort of people. It is a small local rewrite. It'll be something like 2 + 2 = 4. Really, really dumb things that we can basically always perform, and we will always aggressively perform them. So if you see 2 + 2, it will always equal 4, and it will always get lower to that if it ever sees it. And the idea is that we are trying to normalize or canonicalize our IR. So IR is like the way that we represent our program in the backend. So the idea is that anytime that we see any of these more complicated expressions, we simplify them, and that'll make it easier to write passes for later for the stars, basically. So if you've got inlining, you want to have the simplified form of the function before you even decide to inline.
Right. Gotcha. So are there places in there where your theory of how this stuff should work, it differs from LLVM, or is that basically just like state-of-the-art stuff that is mostly settled?
So this is actually one of the bigger pieces where I disagree on LLVM, but I will gloss over a lot of the fun details for me, because they are very boring and very hard to explain. I explained the whole factoring out common terms. And the idea is that with LLVM, there are certain places where it's hard to detect whether or not two terms are the same. So if I have two loads, I can't necessarily say that two loads to the same address are actually the same name, the same value, because they might be happening at two separate places that impose different control flow rules. And so I represent control flow as an input to operations that depend on side effects. And that way, all the dependencies between things like control flow or memory are all considered as part of this giant data flow graph. So I can say that a load is dependent on the last store, the store is dependent on the last, let's say the function entry, because that's where the side effects started, for instance. And this creates a giant graph where I can know more details about dependencies more closely and more clearly, and it makes it easier to talk about the optimizations as an algebra. So like, I can even, so when I say algebra, I mean, I've got this sort of, in the same sense as like math, I've got these names and I can talk about expressions and terms without necessarily saying their exact value. I've sort of abstracted that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're walking along the edge of going over the cliff of where we can actually explain what we're doing, what we're talking about without visuals. And so we're kind of riding that line there. And that might be one of those places where I kind of follow what you mean, but I think without sitting down and looking at code and drawing some diagrams, I probably might not be able to get all the way there. But I find this interesting. So this is where you disagree. This is a spot where you disagree with LLVM. So can you explain just slightly how is there a way to explain how that's different from LLVM that is easy to understand briefly?
So the idea is that the way that I represent my control or my data is you've got these nodes in a graph and I can always deduplicate them. If they look the same, they are the same. LLVM cannot say this about every single node. Some of them have to say, oh, I might look the same, but I'm different. And because I'm positioned somewhere differently, mine are positioned based off of those dependencies. And therefore, they cannot be different if they're in the same position.
I get it. So let me see if I can explain it and you tell me if I've got it right.
Sure.
So LLVM, and I'm not sure if we're talking about the IR or something deeper in the system than the IR.
No, this is the IR. So like at the base of it, there's instruction, which is some class that represents how instructions work.
Okay, got it. So in Clang or LLVM, I mean, the IR is what I don't actually know what it is, but it is something where order matters in the same way that maybe in C code, doing X plus Y higher in the function versus lower in the function matters because I can change X and Y or something. Like something about them can be different at different points in time. And maybe that doesn't exactly map to what is happening in Clang, but in some way in LLVM, but in some way or another, shifting this expression around can make a difference about what it means. But you're saying that in your structure, the data format is almost completely relocatable because you've captured everything that can matter, and there's no way to place it somewhere else that changes the meaning of the data.
Exactly. If it was placed somewhere else, it would look different, and therefore it wouldn't match up.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, so I think that that's about as much getting into it that we could do on this particular topic, but it is super fascinating.
Sure.
Maybe what we can do is I'll have you provide like a list of recommendations for people who want to study further independently, and I'll include that in the description later. But we can move on. So another part of this that I want to get to, and this is something you and I have talked about a little bit before, is as we build optimizations for programs we create, that affects another part of how we program that's super important to me, which is how we debug them, how we inspect them and interact with them while they're alive and running. And so I think the first thing I kind of want to talk about, or have you explain a little bit, is, isn't generating debug info one of the responsibilities of the backend? And do you have that story about TB and how your new structure will work, like how it's going to generate debug information?
Yeah, so currently I don't have, like, I have debug info, but it's not particularly thought through. So I have debug info for PDBs, which is the one that's used on Windows. I don't do Dwarf yet, which is used on like Mac and Linux. So you could compile code on Windows and get debug info and that'd be fine. But it's particularly immature right now. So there's not much to do with preserving variables through optimizations. There's not much to do with scopes and the oddities that come from, oh, I forgot a function that uses the word X like 12 different times. Like, how do I tell those apart?
Mm-hmm. So on a sort of philosophical level, what is your view on the way we should approach compiling things to native code and also debugging them? Because there's a couple of approaches I can imagine. One is sort of the one we do now, which is you mostly compile your code with the lightest weight optimization you can, like very, very unoptimized, where you're kind of preserving each statement and making sure that side effects happen literally and don't get eliminated, even if they could be. That way you can make it pretty easy to generate debug info, and we call that a debug build. It doesn't have all the optimizations, but the debug info works well. And then when you turn on optimizations, you sacrifice some amount of debuggability to make it work so that you can optimize as hard as you want. And then whatever you can preserve in the debug info, you do. And then a flip to that might be to say, we want to optimize as hard as we can while still being able to do debug info, so that the debug info is sort of constraining how hard you optimize, but it's, you're trying to optimize more than what you might do in sort of the dumbest possible translation. And so those are two more obvious things that we could be doing. And right now it feels to me like we're doing more of the first one. With some things you get from the Dwarf debug info, you do get some options to try to really go hard on your optimizations and preserve info. But there are still cases where it's like, you know, some local variable just gets completely eliminated because it actually turns out that it's like, it's counting how often you do something for the purposes of you wanted to see in a debugger that counter, but it doesn't do anything else. And so the compiler can just zap that away completely and there's no recovering it through debug info. So I wonder, what do you think about that? What's the right path for making programs that run fast, but also can be debugged?
So in this case, I fall more into the second camp. And the idea is that we can take programs, we actually don't lose too much if we were to say that I need to optimize the code in such a way where I can still recover the debug info, as long as we make one sort of concession, which is that we're okay with the program not being debuggable at every single instruction. The granularity is not at, I can pause at any instruction and that's what I'm debugging. Because in practice, what you want is variables, you want instructions, you want statements. You want the things that you were staring at in the source code, not necessarily the machine instructions. If you wanted that, that is, in my opinion, a rarer case, and also a not the case we should be optimizing around.
Hmm.
And so to go deeper into that, if I were in some JITted environment, what I can do is I can say, so with a JITted environment, the idea is that you usually start in an interpreter, and then if code is used enough times, it'll get compiled, and then it'll jump into that compiled code, it'll jump out at some point, figure out what's used again, and then do so and sort of cycle through it. Generally speaking, your code will stay in the same places, and so therefore it'll stay in the machine code most of the time, and thus that's where the performance aspect comes in. But the ability to switch back and forth between JIT and interpreter is actually a really interesting property, because it means that we can always switch back to a consistent view of the program that we can debug step. And so we never lose our variables. They're technically still there in some matter or in some form. So maybe they get thrown into, so our debug info in some sort of JIT environment might say, oh, this variable got constant folded, but we can still tell you what that number was. We just like don't represent that in the machine code. We didn't execute that code. It just, we've just kept track of that information. Or maybe that our variable is in a register at certain points. And we can sort of nail down the granularity to something bigger than instruction so that we have an easier time saying that at this point in the code, you can jump out and it would be perfectly fine. So if the user said, if the user clicked the pause button under debugger, you could say, all right, I'm going to stop execution and stop at the nearest place where I can consistently tell you about the program. And these consistent places are called safe points.
Okay, interesting. So I'm going to definitely need to slow that part down and think it through, what the JIT part is going to imply and how this relates to shipping builds and everything about that. But it's let me just go over the last part you said first, because I think that that is maybe the key idea here, is that we're going to start thinking about our code. So I have some source code, right? And when I go to debug it, I don't actually want, usually, like if I'm doing really wonky performance stuff, maybe I do want to step through instructions and understand how they're working. But usually if I wrote source code and I didn't hand roll my own assembly, then I want to debug by stepping through the source code I wrote, not through the disassembly that came out the other side, right? And so if I care about the original source code, the idea is look for points that correspond to, look for ways to arrange the output code so that, you know, you could think of it as like lines of code, or maybe just like semicolons, like where did the side effect happen? Some, there's some kind of granularity you associate to the output instructions to map them back to like ranges, or rather there's things in the source code that map to these ranges of output instructions, right? And so we're saying whenever you get to one of those things, that's what you're calling a safe point, is a spot in the final version of the program that's made out of machine instructions where you could stop. And there's a way to, once you're stopped there, there's a way to inspect the state of the program.
Exactly.
Okay, so you said this is going to involve JITting. So just to lay the groundwork, JIT means just-in-time compiling. So a just-in-time compiling environment would be one where instead of you sending me a fully compiled program, you send me something kind of like the IR, and I have an interpreter that can run that, but I also have a compiler that can take small portions of that, like a function, and compile it as soon as it becomes clear that that piece of the program is going to run a lot. Is that how you would conceptualize it, or are there more details we need to work in there?
I think for the purpose of this, that should be fine. The only thing is to clarify, safe points can actually be implemented into AOT environments. They just happen to be generally beneficial to JIT environments because they usually jump back and forth between interpreter and JIT, but inspecting your program in a consistent way is just a really helpful property. And so we wouldn't need to drop something like C to actually like play around with these ideas.
Okay. Yeah. So the idea of safe points would even work for C without a JIT, basically. You could compile a program to me, and this get reaching a little bit like still, but we're saying you're saying that there's some way we could develop a debug environment that still has this property that at a safe point you can recover all or most all of the state of the program.
Exactly. The idea would be that at certain points, your code is basically, in the same way that you might instrument your code to say, oh, at every function begin and end, I'm going to like do a profiler sample. I might say at every function entry or inside of every loop, there's going to be one safe point poll that's just going to check whether or not the user has tried to pause. And each one of these is going to store enough information to say that if they paused, we can tell them what the state of the program is.
Interesting. Okay, so let me see. I'm gonna slow down and go look at that part some more, because debuggers are something where I do have some insights into how they work. So you're saying that the entire program would basically be instrumented in such a way that there's, I don't know, like a global flag or something somewhere, where if I'm running a program and I get to the beginning of a function or the beginning of a loop, there's just a check there that says, is that flag set? And if so, it would sort of trap out to a debugger.
Exactly. Except in practice, it's not usually a flag and we're not necessarily checking it. There are some interesting details about how you can set this up, but the generally accepted one, at least the one I'm more familiar with, is that you essentially poke a specific page in memory. And the idea is that if the page is around, then it's not going to do anything. It's just going to like load that, and it, since it's an out-of-order CPU, it can load that asynchronously while other stuff is happening. But if you run into the case where you poke that page and the page has been unmapped or it's been set as a guard page, so it tells the compiler or it tells the CPU, hey, this page isn't around, I'm going to segfault in the same way that I might with a null pointer exception, then what ends up happening is that that is like the sort of slow case where we do the actual pausing. And then in this case, we hit an exception and we can check for that specific, oh, we poked this specific page. And now we can jump out of the JITted environment in a way that is really fast to check and really really fast to check, really cheap to sort of embed into your code, because it can be just one instruction that does a load from a page.
Yeah. So let me, we're flipping back to the JIT environment, but I think we were saying that this could also, you could also do this in ahead of time compilation, right?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I did say JIT, but it does apply to any sort of compiler, yeah. And there are reasons why you'd want to do this for AOT.
Okay, so I think a part of that that is sort of interesting is the way a debugger tends to work it for something like C or C++ right now is that when you want to pause, you're directly sending an interruption through, like the operating system mediates this. So it's not, and the operating system would still be mediating this in the way you're describing it. But what wouldn't happen is you wouldn't have to compile in an extra instruction. You could just say, stop wherever you're at. And you don't necessarily, it's not like literally wherever you're at right now because there's communication and delay. But, you know, the process stops and reports to you where it stopped. And I'm wondering, is there some reason why that's not good enough? Because I could imagine a different sort of version of this where instead of having an instruction that pulls, you would just say stop where you're at and then control it single stepping up to the next safe point or something like that. What do you think about that? Does that have a problem or is that a perfectly reasonable way to do it?
So the big reason why you wouldn't want to do this is there's a bunch of oddities that come with pausing execution to do with, like, if you land in certain places, like, let's say if you land in the kernel, you can't modify, you don't get access, or you're not allowed to mutate the registers. It's not your code. And so there are issues with that. And so you land in the wrong places, you just can't pause. And the idea is with save points, you're saying which places you can pause at, and you can consistently stop at those places to avoid these sorts of problems. You could, in theory, just not have the save point pulls and then do the pausing. And then if you hit somewhere where you're not allowed to, like, you know, step through it because it's kernel stuff or something, then you can just continue, pause again, and then, like, sort of retry it. But this is sort of a cheap way to avoid that sort of problem. And there's a few oddities that come with, like, pausing execution this way.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'd have to spend some time thinking about how I would try to get out of the kernel. But yeah, there's some tricks I could think of, but it takes a lot of relying on ways to control the CPU without modifying the behavior of the program, which is a different and separately highly technical set of weeds to get into. So maybe we can avoid that for now. But sure. It is fascinating because I'm thinking about what you're saying, and it's like some of the architecture stuff sounds really cool. We haven't even gotten to some of the stuff that I think sounds really cool. But there are also details like this that make me go like, well, there are some weird things, like we have to inject these new instructions into any program that we want to be able to debug, which we don't have to do with the current thing. So I'm kind of trying to weigh out the pros and cons. Maybe it might be useful to spend a little time explaining. So we're talking about ahead of time compilation a little bit, but we're sort of flipping back into JIT a little bit. So let's just go fully into the JIT world here and tell me a little bit why why would I want to be doing JIT rather than ahead of time compilation?
So the big win is that the code that gets optimized and the code that gets compiled is going to have a better understanding of the sort of running program. And so an example of this is that we might in Clang say, oh, I want to use PGO, which is profile guided optimization. We want to say that the inliner should be guided by which functions are hot functions and which functions are cold functions. Mm. So if something gets hit a lot, it's a hot function. If something does not get hit a lot, then it's a cold function. And the idea is with a JIT, we can actually do these optimizations live and we can optimize around a lot of more dynamic environments. So we can say that if I were to load in new code and attach it to my my pre-existing code, I can have that like boundary instead of it being mitigated by ABI, which is basically how we might talk between two pieces of code that don't really know what they're talking to. Mm-hmm. We can join these two pieces in such a way where they're allowed to literally inline across that boundary. And we're allowed to do that dynamically. We're allowed to, in terms of the profiling aspect, we're allowed to say things like this piece of code is dynamic or this piece of code is static. Even if that piece of code was annotated as being dynamic, it could still be static in a sense of like throughout the run of your program, it's like it's constant. Mm. And those details are something that is hard to capture in AOT. And the other huge one is the ability to say that certain CPU features can be targeted directly without the user having to compile a bunch of different variants of the program. So the user compiles one version of the program, or the user has one version of the program. They pass it off to the JIT. The JIT will see what CPU features you have and then optimize accordingly. So an example might be there's different versions of SIMD on your CPU. If you have a better one, it might choose a better instructions because of that.
Okay. So yeah, that's a couple of reasons, and those all sound like they sound like the kind of reasons that aren't just like those aren't facing the developer and saying this will make your life easier kinds of reasons. These are actually like we could make programs that go even faster using this technology, right? So if I ahead of time compile. I'm just going to run over the same ground again in a slightly different order here. So if I ahead of time compile, I have to know things like the CPU the user is going to run, or at least what instructions are going to work on that CPU. I have to kind of fix that. And with a JIT, you can sort of dynamically pull, like, hey, does the CPU go all the way up to SSE4? Does it have AVX? And change what instructions you're using to accomplish certain, you know, to accomplish that translation of the program down into the lowest level machine code. And it sounds like you're also saying something else fascinating, which is that you can optimize it based on the profile of the program that's actually running. So it's not about looking at this. This part of it isn't about looking at the CPU, but it's about looking at, hey, this particular loop is actually running a lot, so spending more time optimizing this by looking at what we could inline or how we could unroll it or whatever will pay off, whereas there's no way to know that when you're just a compiler because you don't actually have any insight, unless you do something fancy, you don't have any insight about what pieces of code are going to be hot when the user runs the code.
Exactly. The idea is sort of tied into Omdahl's law of, you know, there are certain pieces of your code that are just hot code. There are certain pieces of your code that are cold code. The hot code is the one that actually matters to optimize. Like if 90% of your code is cold and there's like a 10% that's hot, the 10% or like, sorry, that was like a bad explanation. But the idea is if we have hot code and we have cold code, we want to prioritize hot code in terms of optimizations. It actually wouldn't really matter to a lot of my code if there were certain pieces that were interpreted, if they just weren't run enough times.
Mm. Yeah. So on the flip side, like from the perspective of someone using a C compiler today, if you turn on the high, you know, the heavy hitting optimizations and you run it on your whole program, that can take orders of magnitude longer than the simple build right now. And so while I can understand that once the optimizations are done, having this insight into the dynamics of the program could let you optimize better, I think a flip side to that that people will be concerned about is, don't I pay a price for doing the optimization work at runtime?
Yeah, you would end up paying a cost at runtime. The question of whether or not that cost is worth it is, I guess, the sort of deeper question and sort of a trade-off that you're going to need to make yourself. But when it comes to something that is like a sort of state-of-the-art JIT, one of the big things is that they, unlike LLVM, they do prioritize things like compile time because they play into how fast the code runs. If you take too long to compile some code, then that's more time you're spending in an interpreter or in a template JIT, which is like basically a very, very dumb JIT that just like compiles like every single instruction in like the dumbest pattern just so that it can like run machine code. Mm. And so this is basically like it's maybe a bit faster than interpreters, and that's the reason why people do it. And so the idea is the more time you spend compiling, the slower your program is going to be in the sort of short term. And that might be important, and that is important in practice. And thus, the compile times end up being a lot faster for something like a JIT, especially because it doesn't need to compile everything. It just needs to compile what matters. And it has more information about certain analysis that the compiler would normally have to do that it no longer has to guess on. So like, oh, I don't have to do a full giant call graph to figure out how to inline something. I don't have to say, oh, maybe I should inline this way or that way. I can just say, yeah, this code got hit like 10,000 times. It's probably something we should inline.
Interesting. So you're saying, well, first of all, you're saying what I would expect, which is that if you're going to JIT and you're going to, if you're the developer of a JIT environment, you're going to take that into account and try to write a faster compiler than what you would have to write if you were doing like a batch processing version of an optimizer.
Yeah.
But also you're saying that the optimization problem is significantly different, that when you're sort of off in batch processing land and you send off your whole program, it's going to analyze the whole program. And so it's got this big complex web of functions to analyze, and it has no insight into what's actually going to be hot paths unless it does a lot of sort of guesswork based on heuristics. And in the JIT world, a lot of those problems are gone so that the optimizing problem looks different than it does in the batch processing problem.
Yeah, I would say the big thing is that they are both compilers and they both work generally the same way. The usual key differences have to do with we export into a file versus we export into memory. Mm-hmm. And then the analysis stuff is actually something that you can bring over to AOT land. And this is what PGO is. You turn it on, you record some trace of your program, and you feed that back into the compiler and tell it, hey, I've given you some information about what the critical paths are. And now you can ideally inline better. You can ideally unroll which loops are hot, and you can care about the important pieces of the code.
Mm-hmm. So those are all reasons to do JIT that make it faster. Do you think there's any... Does the JIT also play a role in making the debugging story work better, or are those completely disconnected?
I would say that usually the JIT... it's sort of adjacent, but they happen to be correlated. The idea is that usually when you have JITs, you need some way to jump back into interpreter land where things are not JIT compiled yet. And that need to be able to jump back into the interpreter is more of the important piece for improving the debugger story, in my opinion, than it is to actually have a JIT. So like you could have an AOT language where you can jump to an interpreter or to some view of like the program that's like consistent so you can step through it that doesn't require any sort of dynamic compilation.
Okay. That's interesting. So the JIT, it's sort of like the JIT problem, it forces you to solve the problem of having an interpreter layer and a low-level layer. And the JIT is the ability to, like, JIT by itself just means the ability to take something that's running on the interpreter layer and move it down to the low-level layer and run it there when you need to. That's what the JIT provides.
Generally speaking, yeah.
Yeah. Your ideal, what you're pitching for an architecture for debugging any kind of program, whether it's a JIT or not, is to kind of take that same idea but run it the other way to say if something is currently not in an interpreted sort of state, or how do I want to put this? It's not running in an interpreted environment. It's compiled down to low level. If there was a way to take that and raise it back up to an interpreter, then the debugger could be implemented just to understand the interpreter, and it wouldn't have to do this deeper understanding of the low-level stuff, which is how we do things right now.
Exactly. The problem of, oh, sorry, your variable got optimized out, would sort of have to be solved for the JIT, but you could also solve it for AOT with the same solutions where you say, oh, I've actually preserved this value. So, like, you know, it might have gotten deleted, but, like, It's less that it got deleted as in I've removed it, but more that I've put it either to the side, so either on the stack, or I've said that it's been reduced to some constant expression or some other variation of things that I can say to make it so that by the time that you pause execution and the debugger wants to see things, what it sees is an array of variables that just tell it, here's the things that are live right now, and here's where execution is at.
Interesting. So it's not quite a reverse JIT, because you're not talking about taking a low-level program and literally like transpiling it back up, right? That's the part that I think is really interesting, is how does this hoisting it back up, how would we go about making that work? I think we might need to like slow that part down and flesh it out more. So would it be that it's a part of the compiler's job to not only generate the program, but also right now what a compiler does is generate a program and it generates debug info. And what the debug info does is it tells a debugger how to map ideas from the source code down to the low level. So it says like, here's variable X. You can find it at this offset from the beginning of the frame or in this register or whatever. And your version wouldn't be debug information that maps from source code concepts down to the low level. It would be instructions on how to take the low level state and map it up to an interpreter state.
Yeah. So to sort of narrow in, generally speaking, when you write debuggers, they are written as a separate program that attaches to your process, and then it introspects your process. So it's this sort of parent process that just says, I'm going to poke and prod at your variables, at your registers, and I'm going to use the debug info to figure out what they mean at any time. The idea is that, generally speaking, in the interpreter model, you can do the debugging in the same process, and it's generally beneficial to do so.
Interesting.
Because there's nothing, you don't depend on certain OS features to deal with introspection. You can just, I don't have to do debug stepping using the OS features to say, oh, I want you to pause in this way and like resume the thread. I pause the thread by doing the save point polling. And so that's an exception that I can capture and then I can jump into some other code. And so I don't need to ask the OS for much more than the ability to do exceptions and virtual memory, as opposed to needing to ask it for the debugger API or how to do its unwind info or stuff like that. That's all delegated to me. And then so I guess we can narrow in on that if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. So I definitely think I'm getting a different picture of this than I've had before, which I'm really interested in. So to go over that again, the architecture of debuggers that we have in the land of C and C++ is that the thing you want to debug is the program you wrote, and it's a process. And then you have a second process called the debugger, and the operating system provides ways for debugger processes to take control of another process and read and write their state in such a way that we get, you know, we can take that, we combine it with the ability to interpret debug information from the compiler, and together these two things, so the operating system mediating the control of the target process and the debug info from the compiler that made the program in the first place, come together, and then a debugger implementer kind of puts a UI on top of that and figures out how to wrangle all of that. And that's a separate program that someone else writes and that you can use to point at any program. And what you're talking about is, instead of a debugger being a tool that points at another process, every process comes with stuff baked in for debugging itself. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. There's a really cool example of this in Lua, which is that it's called debugger.lua. It's a GitHub project, and it's really cool, but essentially it is a debugger written inside of Lua, and it uses some of the Lua debug functions to do hooking onto itself to step through lines. And so the idea is that once you've done this like hooking stuff, and because Lua can talk about its environment, which is basically the so Lua is all tables, it's key value pairs all everywhere. And so the idea is that the environment is basically the magic key value pair in the sky that owns every single variable. So you can view all of your globals in there and all your functions. And then from there, you can introspect what's inside of those functions and etc. And the ability to talk about your environment within the language is sort of what debug info, or usually we delegate this to the debugger can talk about the environment within your code. But I'm saying that I think that it'd be better if we could talk about the environment within our own code. And so some examples of this might be that some languages have runtime type info. You might see Jai or Odin have this stuff. And that is a form of talking about your program within itself dynamically, which is actually beneficial to this sort of this new debugging story.
Interesting. So it sounds like, and I think there's a couple more of these things coming up in my head now that are concerns that sort of I react with this story, which is one of them is that it sounds like we're talking about building a fairly heavy runtime into every program, right? So it's in the C land, for instance, you can kind of strip it down to the point where the only runtime that there is something that you yourself wrote that's a couple of functions, and your program is literally just instructions on the CPU. And at that point, like the only thing you could call the runtime is the CPU itself, maybe. But the idea of a runtime when you go higher and higher up is that your program is all the code you wrote plus some machinery that is there to run all the code you wrote. And so if we're going to already have the idea of an interpreter and a JIT, that's a part of a runtime where the runtime now includes the ability to run the code uncompiled, the ability to compile it down and then manage the pieces that it has compiled and link them together and so that it can run those instead of running the interpreter at appropriate times. How heavy do you think that runtime gets? And is it worth preserving a version of programming where there isn't such a heavy runtime? Or do you think that like everything could run on a runtime and actually it wouldn't have to be that big a deal?
So the main argument I would give against the sort of large runtime is something like LuaJIT. LuaJIT is actually really tiny. It's, I think, somewhere around 300 kilobytes. And so embedding that into your program or having a program written in it would not be the craziest thing. And it's not impossible to write other lightweight runtimes in this way. I would actually argue that, well, you're always paying some sort of runtime cost in the sense of there are systems that are being managed. The question is, where are those systems? So usually it's like OS stuff, but there's also stuff like the C runtime, which will handle things like the heap. And the heap comes with its own costs, like it will try to consume memory every time that you use it. It will come at the cost of trying to... So usually the heap is implemented very poorly. And so it'll come at some cost of just like beyond just, oh, we pay memory costs when we allocate from it. It is like usually written with a giant lock on it. And so it's going to be particularly slow. And we might say, okay, in that case, I will just drop the heap. The idea is that you want to drop these things, but you're going to replace them with your own stuff. That's going to be your sort of runtime support, your arenas, your custom allocators and whatever. And what I would like is that we sort of bake down that bottom layer of stuff that we would appreciate to have in our runtime to things that we actually care about. So if you don't care about the heap, you shouldn't have it, sure. But if you're a person who cares about certain kinds of debugging that I might, you might be okay with paying the cost of saying, oh, my debug builds just mean that I have save points in them. And there's a like a consistent mapping to the bytecode, and then I can, you know, I can introspect my own code, debug step it within itself. And then so I can write an integrated debugger in 500 lines like they did in Lua.
Interesting. So I think that maps to a way that I think about my C code, because as you said, I'm the sort of person who does eliminate some portions of the C runtime. I get off of malloc and switch to arena, and I end up building a layer in my code base that I call the base layer, which contains, you know, some stuff that is just like helper macros that I like, but a big chunk of it is the stuff that I want to be able to assume it kind of binds everything together, like my custom allocators and how I'm going to organize data for a couple of key types that are going to, you know, be passed around like strings and things like that. So I can see how if you take that idea and say like, well, yeah, you got off of the C runtime, but you built this new chunk of code that binds everything else together and you called that your base layer. That's essentially just a new runtime that you have built. Mm-hmm. And so then if you're going to have a base layer that binds everything together, and the idea is you're going to like put your best stuff there that really helps you build, like it sort of defines what it means to write programs on top of that, which is how I tend to think about it. I tend to think of like, if I've got arenas in my base layer, that's going to completely change what kind of programs I write versus if I'm writing them all on top of malloc. So this base layer or this runtime which I'm sort of sensing are like similar ideas,
yeah.
define the shape of what kind of programs you can build on top. And you're saying, well, at this base layer slash runtime thing, let's take debugging seriously and let's take optimizations of code seriously so that we can get both simultaneously. That seems like a valuable thing. Why not build a program, like a style of program that can do both of those things really well?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a really compelling story. I think I'm getting a better picture of this than I've ever had before, because I hadn't realized that it was not a separate debugger anymore. It's a built-in debugger. I think there are parts of that that I'm not entirely understanding yet. So, like, would it mean that if you want to debug your program, there's, like, APIs for just saying, it wouldn't be an API that says pause my program. I guess, yeah, walk me through what it would mean to pause a program. I've got a program I've written in this way, and I'm detecting something is going wrong, and I want to stop it and inspect its state. How does that happen?
Sure. So I'll walk through it in the like debugger like .lua style, which because I think that it is one of the more simple like embedded debugger setups. You basically just say require. It's like a single file, and then once you've got that in, if you tell it to debug break, it will step into a debugger, and then you can debug step in there, you can evaluate expressions, check the state, etc. And the idea is that it mostly is just a wrapper, like a command line wrapper over a few functions in the Lua standard library. So these functions boil down to set hook, things around seeing what the locals are, so like the local variables at that time, seeing what the call stack is like, so being able to do like all that unwinding stuff. And the idea is that you can do set hook so that you can stop at statements, you can stop at function entries or exits. And the idea is that within your program, you might have, let's say we wanted to do a sort of asynchronous thing, because it makes more sense to do that if you're going to do a visual debugger. So the debugger doesn't like pause to wait for you to like input things. It's just continuously running. It has its own GUI. It might do graphics and stuff. And so the idea is that your program is running within this debugger. It's been loaded into the debugger and it's been told, hey, I'm going to pause you sometimes. I'm going to set hook sometimes. And I'm going to say set hook every time that you hit a statement. And then it's going to go, okay, you've told me that. I'm going to pause at the nearest statement. And then so usually the initial pause is not something that's like, per statement. It's usually, so unless it's like an explicit, I want to stop at this line, or it's, I want to, it's usually I want to stop at this line, or it's, I click the pause button and it's going to stop as soon as possible.
Yeah. Can we hold on? I think there's one piece here that I definitely want to make sure I caught, and I'm not sure that I fully get it. What am I interacting with when I communicate something like I want to stop at this line, for instance? Do I have a separate window that's a separate program, or the program automatically launches in debug mode and has a separate window for that? Or like what is the thing that I interact with that sends the initial signal? I want to make sure I caught that part.
So the idea is that the compiler is giving you a bunch of introspection tools, and so you're building a bunch of stuff on top of it. So you could actually build it out as a GUI or as a thing that works in the command line or whatever else you might want to do. Like maybe you want to pass it over the wire or something. And the idea is, let's say we did it as like a separate window. So you embed this debugger and it pops up a little window that's just going to be your debugger view. It's going to be your watch window and a few other like random things like that. The idea is you click the pause button. You're telling the main program, hey, Mr. Interpreter, I want to jump into your code. Please trigger the next save point and jump out. And then it will jump out. It'll tell you, all right, I've jumped out. Now all of the state of the program is something you can stare at. So usually it wasn't something you could stare at. It's sort of like locked. It's like a locked resource. And so it was, oh, it's all in the JIT state. It's like, you know, woozy in there. We don't know what's going on. It's been optimized. The second you say, hey, please stop, it'll stop at the nearest save point. It'll give you a consistent view of the program. And then you can go, all right, I'm going to display a bunch of your variables into the GUI. And so like what that looks like from your perspective is you're interacting with this little library that says pause, that says things like read the stack trace, read the local variables. And the view that you get from that isn't, oh, the local variables in REX. No. It's been unpacked for you. And then what you can do is, if you were to tell it to resume, it would just ramp back up to speed. And so in a JITted environment, it would ramp back up and eventually start running in the JIT again.
Okay.
if you're in an AOT environment, you might just take the thing and then debug step until you reach another function you can jump back into. Or you might actually be able to jump back into the original save point as long as you kept track of what registers need to go in which places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let me... I think I'm getting the picture even better now. So some of that stuff we'll get to. Mm-hmm. But the piece that I think was key there that I got this time through it is... The runtime itself doesn't have to include an entire Visual Studio clone or something.
Exactly.
Like that. All the runtime does is provide a relatively thin interface, which is the key information that you would need, like variables that are local, variables that are global, the stack, the how to roll back the stack. If you have, you know, if this supports threads, maybe you have a little story about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, all in all, it's not crazy. Beyond that, it's just this building of this data structure, essentially, of the current state. And if it's a JIT environment, then maybe it includes also the interpreter state that you could use to run forward. If it's an AOT, maybe that gets trickier and you are just sort of paused there and you can't modify the state. But you have this runtime that can construct this data structure that exposes the current sort of interface that you would of data.
Mm-hmm.
But then if I wanted, say, a Visual Studio style experience, instead of downloading a program called, like, you know, Remedy or Visual Studio or whatever, I download essentially a library
mm-hmm.
and bake it into my program. And that library has a UI that boots up with the program if I've, like, enabled it. You know, I run it with debug mode. Then when I'm running my program, whether or not I'm going to debug it, it has this debugger built in and can inspect its state. And if I wanted to make a version that didn't have that, I would just sort of hide out that I'd compile out the visual debugger. But you also wouldn't have to use a particular visual debugger. You could say, like, oh, I want my program to be debugged by a command line thing or something custom that I wrote myself. And so the idea becomes you can relatively trivially build all kinds of stuff that depends on inspecting the state, and a Visual Studio style debugger might be more than what you want to do on every single project, but that can also just be a library now.
Exactly. Have you heard of the project Whitebox?
Yeah.
So Whitebox has this nice little trick where they say, we're going to show you the program as like a sort of trace. We're going to show you what the values, how the values change over time. In theory, you could implement your own as like an embedded thing for whatever visualizations you wanted for your program. So, like, let's say you have a bunch of entities in the world and you want it to pause execution. You say, I want to pause, I want to step out and say, what does the game state look like at this point in time? And then mm-hmm. visualize all of the game state. So, like, let's say we've got like this rendering command buffer and we say, this is where the sprites are at. I can, while at mid frame, I can pause execution, I can search for where that game state is held, I find it, and then I can put a widget up that literally just shows here's what my understanding of where the sprites are at goes based off of like custom code I've written myself. And so I don't have to depend on anybody else to say, I've made the right visualizations for you. I can write my own visualizations. And a lot of like the hard problem of saying, oh, why don't I just make a debugger is like taken away just because of this consistency of like being able to step into the interpreter and being able to introspect the program.
Yeah. I might be at the limit right now of where I can spot this. I need to let this architecture sit with me for a little while, but I think I think I'm getting some of it. And I'd be very curious, you know, I think this is all another part where we'd have to get into the weeds, but I'd be very curious to see exactly how lightweight this can get. You're saying LuaJIT can do a lot of this and it's only 300K. How much heavier does it get if you want to do like a C-like language that compiles all the way down to native during the JIT? Although I don't know if Lua these days does have a JIT, doesn't it?
Yeah, so LuaJIT has an interpreter JIT, and LuaJIT is what's called a trace-based JIT, and so the idea is that it says this stream of instructions is going to be hot. Usually it's like a loop or something, and it'll then compile it.
Mm.
The other option is like function-based or method-based, where it'll say, I've hit this function enough times, it's hot, therefore compile this function, or usually 99% of the time, because this is one of the funny things, which is that usually what they'll land on is something that they really don't want to JIT, and so it'll be things like a getter or a setter, And you don't want to JIT a getter and setter. You want to JIT the thing that actually used it. And so usually they have to like 9 times out of 10, it'll end up JITting like 40 functions together, which is not particularly slow. It's just like, it's just sort of funny to see that every, like, the JIT developers have to like cope with the fact that the code looks very, very weird. Like, I don't necessarily have much of a problem with getters and setters as like, oh, I want to grab data and set data and stuff like that. It's more of like, I consider it a, it sort of pretends to be an abstraction, but like just wrapping over a field and an object is not abstraction.
Right. And just to understand how this ties back, the point is these tiny little functions whose purpose is to return or assign something are not worth JITting on their own, because presumably, you know, and I haven't thought a lot about how this works, so maybe this would be an interesting piece of the architecture to develop mm-hmm. a little bit more. So something I don't understand about JITs are, I know how an interpreter works and I know how a compiled program works, but with a JIT, you have like a patchwork. You have like everything starts off interpreted, some things start getting compiled. What is the path like for when something was in the interpreter and then you go to a play, like it suddenly has to make a jump to native code, and then when that native code runs to the end, like we run to the end of the function and return, it has to make has another path back up out of that into the interpreter again. What exactly does that look like?
All right, so let's imagine we have like we have a little library, and all we can call is step. And so all it does is just take from the start of the program and just step forward one operation at a time. And every time it steps into a function, it steps into the instructions of it. It makes it to the return and exits out. Now, what I'm looking for actually is that I don't actually, like, I can't introspect the state while it's stepping. I have to, like, pause it to then introspect it. So I've sort of got, like, this locked resource, and I say, I'm stepping right now. I'm busy right now. I'll pause you when I'm ready to, like, stare at your state. But for now, if you stepped and you hit a function and that function could be compiled and it might be worthy of compiling, then we'll just say, oh, I'll pretend like I jumped into that code and I ran that code, but I didn't really. I just like, I didn't step through it in the interpreter. I actually just pretended to in the JIT. And then the JIT will basically jump in. It'll take whatever interpreter state. And so there'll be like a trampoline, which is like this little function that just says, I'm going to take the state from the interpreter and I'm going to convert it into something the JIT wants to understand. And then the idea is that the JIT will run through a bunch of code, and then eventually it'll make it out. Well, generally speaking, it'll make it out either because other functions that it needs to call are in the interpreter because they haven't been compiled yet, or because it hit some failure case. So like sometimes with unlikely cases, they'll just be told, hey, jump out of the JIT because we hit some error or something. Like if you did bounce checking or something, and you say, oh, the bounce checking isn't written in the JIT. It just says, jump out, we threw an exception, damn.
Yeah.
And so the idea is, now it jumps back into the interpreter. And so from the perspective of the user, all they did is call step, and step would just keep advancing forward. And usually it's not written as like step. Usually it's like you call a run function, it'll run a snippet of code, and it'll give you back the result. And so within that, as it's stepping through, it can switch back and forth between the JIT and the interpreter. They both have different notions of what like things like local variables or parameters look like.
Yeah.
But the idea is that there is trampolines between them that say, well, so they don't have to necessarily be like separate functions. They could just be like little stubs at the top of the function that just say the variables used to exist on like the interpreter's like let's say it's a stack VM. It used to have like a little three variables on the stack that I need to grab because those are my parameters. I'm going to pop those off as the JIT, and then I'm going to put those in a registers, and then I'm going to run through a bunch of code with it. And then when it says to, this is called deoptimization, and the term basically has to do with, when you're in the JIT and you hit a case that you have not compiled yet, what you'll do is you'll say, all right, I'm going to do the safe point thing. I'm going to just say, I have a consistent view of the program here. I'm going to use that to just exit.
I see. Okay, so I hadn't understood that piece yet, and now more of this is clicking. So I'm going to run over it again. I know this is kind of going, we're kind of getting through it slowly, but I feel like I am chipping away and being able to understand more and more of how this sort of stuff works. So I appreciate it a lot. The piece I was missing is that when you build a JIT system, you are always doing these safe points. I hadn't realized that before, because when you just have an interpreter, you just, you know, you run and mm-hmm. you get to the end, or you get to some state where the interpreter says, oh, we're done with interpreting, and then you're done. But with a JIT in the mix, you don't change that. You're still making it look to the user like the interpreter is just running. But what's happening is you've got some block of code, and when you get to a point where you used to like run some virtual machine instructions or whatever, now you're going to hit an instruction that's basically like, oh, this path now bounces over to this low-level thing. So instead of running forward on the interpreter with these instructions, we call to the low-level thing. And somehow we've packaged up the information that describes how you convert interpreter state into something that that low-level function will understand. And it could even be as simple as saying we pass state pointer, like we got a state struct and we pass its pointer. And so the real, like the original code we wrote in source code might be a function with a few parameters that it's going to do some work with. At the low level, you have a function that maybe just says, I take a state pointer and I unpack, like I read out of the state pointer the things that I need in order to then go and do all the low-level stuff I've compiled into the JIT version of this code. And when I get to a safe point that is if I get to a piece of code that I haven't already compiled, then when I was compiling this, I knew I didn't already compile that, and I wrote some instructions there that said, okay, now what we need to do is finally return back to that VM loop that called me in the first place, and in order to get there, I need to do that safe point thing where I take the low-level state and I hoist it back up into an interpreter state. And so what I guess I hadn't realized is that this isn't just a new idea for making debugging work. That's always something you are doing if you write a JIT system.
Exactly. That's what I meant by the ideas are adjacent. It happens to be that JIT people have to solve this problem to make the interpreter JIT like interaction work.
Yeah. No, I get that now. I think I did not fully see that, but I think chipping away at it, we got there, and I see how if you write a JIT system, you are already solving a problem for how to build a debugger that could work even for completely ahead of time compiled code.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, I think that I'm maybe at the end of what I can do in terms of handling new ideas right now. So I think for a final topic, instead of chipping away at this architecture, I just wonder if you can give us a quick idea of stuff you're working on right now that people can check out, things you're thinking about, something like along those lines.
Sure. So the big one is QuickenTB. So I've been working on QuickenTB for almost 2 years now. It's getting close. And the idea is that Quick is the C compiler, and it is getting close to self-hosting. I'm like compiling more and more pieces of code. I've got like some STB image demo working, which has been really fun. It's it's basically some spinning triangle with a texture of burgers put on top of it that was compiled with a STB image, and then that's like a showcase of, oh look, the compiler is working. And from start to finish, it has always been the case that the goal has been, I want to make sure that debug builds at least are going to compile significantly faster than Clang. And that's never stopped being true. It's never been that, like, one of the things I remember hearing a lot was going to be that, oh, I'm going to hit some feature that's going to be like, oh, I'm going to have to like break everything, and then it'll make it all slower just like magically. And it's not really been the case. Actually, certain features have exposed, I've learned a lot over the 2 years, and so I've learned how to improve certain things either about the front end or the back end to make them faster. I've fixed architecture details that LLVM has now recently fixed, so like to do with they use opaque pointers, which so in the back end the idea is that an opaque pointer is just, it's like a void pointer, it just like, it doesn't say what it's pointing to, it just says that it is a pointer. And then the idea is that the load and store instructions tell you what they're pointing to,
right?
And so I just did that from the start because I don't have a 20-year-old code base. I can get certain things right the first time, which is a really good thing to do, and especially if it gets me to avoid the pitfalls of something like LLVM. The other thing I've been working on is I've got a bunch of like random toy projects, some of them being like game stuff, which are like unannounced and like just sit around in the backlog. But the other one has been, I'm still working on a fourth JIT. So fourth is this stack language that came out in, what, I think the 70s? And the idea is that it's very simple. It's basically just all pushing and popping from a stack, and then putting those pushes and pops, giving them names, and then those are called words, and then we can call those words, and now we can push things without like necessarily having to write out all that code. And I've been writing a JIT for that, and so my variation of Forth has been dealing with some of those oddities. That's sort of the main thing I've been working on. Those are the main things I've been working on, with Quick also being very associated with TB, the backend. Mm-hmm. Most of my time has realistically been spent, like at least the last few months, has been spent on TB. I've been working with Ginger Bill on setting up Odin with TB, and so that's been an ongoing process, but it's already shown some good results. We've gotten some small examples working, and hopefully we can get more of the Odin stuff compiling to TB, compiling correctly, and eventually I want to progress to supporting more languages. The point of being a backend that's like a flexible library that everyone should want to use is that I'm sort of playing this mediator role where a bunch of people who all disagree on what the semantics of their language are, or maybe disagree on the interfaces to them, can all boil their stuff down to something that I can optimize. And usually computation sort of has this way of showing itself as like being really unified, where everyone has some way of writing 2 + 2 = 4. And so like that, being able to represent that, is like, that is what my job is. My job is to make the thing that lets you write the two, the plus and the two, that right. makes sense for people.
Right. Where can people go to check out these projects and chat with you about them and stuff like that?
So I've got a Quick Discord. I don't really use it much, which is unfortunate, but I hang around Handmade Network quite a bit. If you go to my GitHub, which github.com/realnegate/quick. You can, by the way, so to clarify, Quick is spelled C-U-I-K. I've gotten some confusion about that before, but it was supposed to be a pun on the word C and quick. Yeah, so realnegate/C-U-I-K. And then that's where my repo is. There's a link to the Discord in there. If you're on Windows, you can try out some of the demos, and if you hop into the Quick Discord, I can walk you through how to like get those up and running and see like for yourself and understand some of the like weirder details, and so we can discuss about that stuff.
Nice. Cool. Well, I think that's everything I've got for today. Thanks so much for coming and chatting with me. I've learned a lot from this.
Yeah, thank you for having me.